Good morning, it is 11 a.m. and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. At their April 15th meeting, Council unanimously voted to explore creative social investment options to tackle the housing and homelessness crisis. According to data from the City of Kingston, as of January 2025, 503 individuals are experiencing homelessness in the Kingston community, and more are precariously housed. The city currently has a goal of creating 480 affordable housing and supportive housing units by the end of 2026. With an eye towards sustainable development and greater civic engagement, the city is exploring the use of community bonds as a tool to fund affordable housing initiatives. The motion states it is looking to encourage residents and local organizations to invest directly in community projects, while ensuring that the financial benefits, such as interest payments, remain within the community. The city's chief financial officer, Desiree Kennedy, explained what this could look like for the city before council.
The community bonds, so they are a type of social bond, and they are used generally to, the focus of them is generally to have a return that's more around social or environmental impacts, so some sort of a positive social impact. They are a community bond in that they do focus on community engagement as opposed to, say, a municipality just going and issuing a bond and doing something. This is about the community being engaged and coming up with solutions, one of which would be a community bond. The other thing is that they tend to be smaller values so that public can participate and be part of what the solution is. They have been used, there's actually a couple of housing examples within Ontario where they've been used. They generally are issued by a not-for-profit or a charity organization, not always by a municipality, though I know the City of Toronto does issue social bonds for various things, but they tend to be more issued through a community. I'm not as familiar, and I think part of this research will be the process around it and how that works, what the interest rate might look like, and potentially it could be a little bit of a lower interest rate if investors are willing to give up some rate in terms of seeing that the impact happening from the bond.
Community bond utilization can be found throughout the province. Examples including Toronto's Social Debenture Program, Kensington Market Community Land Trust, and Haliburton County's Places for People. Kennedy also noted that the city will most likely not incur extra administrative costs.
I think that's part of the research that we will do. I don't see it. I think potentially it would be another entity that would be working to issue those bonds. There is actually a company in Toronto that helps to assist smaller entities with respect to issuing these types of bonds as well. And that's part of the research we will do, is to reach out and have a conversation with them. But certainly, sort of at first glance, without doing more research, I really don't see it as being something that would be a cost administrative to the city.
Councillor Connie Glenn, who sits on the Housing and Homelessness Advisory Committee, motivated the motion, a task that has been in the works for quite some time, according to Councillor Jeff McLaren.
I just want to bring attention to the fact that you were leading this community bond thing through the Housing and Homelessness Advisory Committee. It's something that we've been trying to do for almost two terms now, and you got it done. So thank you very much for your leadership on this.
Staff will provide the Housing and Homelessness Committee and Council with an information report by the third quarter of 2025 with best practices for social investment options. At their last meeting, Council received an update on the Integrated Care Hub and approved $500,000 to keep their shelter services up and running. The Integrated Care Hub is located at 661 Montreal Street, supported by a group of organizations: Addiction and Mental Health Services, Kingston Frontenac Lennox and Addington, Kingston Community Health Centers, Providence Care, Trellis HIV and Community Care, and Homebase Housing. The ICH provides low-barrier services to individuals in need, including a place to rest, meals, and harm reduction supplies. After the September 2024 incident, where two people were killed in the area surrounding the hub and the nearby Bell Park encampment, Councillor Gregory Ridge proposed the ICH present a security and safety plan and form a community consultation group to continue receiving funding from the city. In addition to these conditions, which were met by the ICH, the motion asked city staff to compile a report with information and safety metrics related to the operation of the Integrated Care Hub. This report was presented to Council at their April 15th meeting. Councillor Ridge noted the steep increase in emergency services since the establishment of the ICH in a question to the city's Commissioner of Community Services, Jennifer Campbell.
So I want to start by saying, you know, based on the data tables and the reports that are contained therein, there's a lot to parse there. But I'm going to start with, based on the data that's presented in the report and any data that may be available to staff with regards to increases in emergency response throughout the city, are there any other areas of the city that have 176% increase in fire response, a 313% increase in paramedic response, or a 372% increase in police response from 2020 to 2021?
Commissioner Campbell, go ahead.
Thank you, and through you. No, there is not.
However, Ridge also noted the important care the ICH has provided to the community's most vulnerable residents, including their crucial food program.
But I do also want to highlight from the report, there were over 38,000 meals served in 2020. There were over 39,000 served in 2021, just shy of that. So, I think that this is a step in the right direction.
588 unique individuals accessed ICH services from April 1st, 2024 to January 31st, 2025. The report also included a recommendation from a 2022 third-party review of the ICH that select services should be spread out across Kingston. Councillor Tozo underscored what control the city has in terms of ushering in suggested changes.
One of the recommendations was that some of these services put together can cause some exaggerated challenges for the area. And some of the recommendations are separating some of these services out, if I'm reading the report correctly. The other challenge I'm just trying to figure out is we don't control all these services. It's a consortium of partners. I just want to get this on the public record. The city is one small player in a much larger consortium of agencies that are there, and this is provincially funded for the major services.
The conversation around the horseshoe is short, but the community consultation group, which includes neighbors, business owners, community service providers, ICH service providers, and councillors, plans to discuss the new information in more detail, according to Councillor Gregory Ridge. Council unanimously approved the allocation of $500,000 specifically to support shelter operations at the Integrated Care Hub until March 31, 2026. The ICH provided 619 overnight stays in their rest zone in January 2025 alone. Kingston Health Sciences Center has provided an update on their robotic surgery program, reporting that for the first time at Kingston Health Sciences Center, two separate robotic procedures, gallbladder surgery and colorectal surgery, were performed at the same time. It's a milestone that represents streamlining in surgical care, changing what's possible in a single hospital stay. Dr. Sunil Patel, a surgeon at Kingston Health Sciences Center, spoke with CFRC about KHSC's robotic surgery program and the significance of this procedure.
It's called robotic surgery, but it's not like there's a robot sitting at the bedside cutting and pasting like you see for RoboCop or something. So really what the robotic platform is the surgeon sits at what looks like a really fancy and advanced virtual reality type console. The surgeon can control every aspect of the robot through that console, can get a 3D vision view and kind of looks through an optical port. The robot itself is separate from that and actually is the thing that sits beside the patient. It has these complex arms that hold the instruments, moves the instruments as we want them to move, and also holds the camera. The third part of the robot is kind of the interface. It's like the main hub of the robot, which is basically the interface between the surgeon and the robotic platform itself. So it's not like we press a button, go get coffee in the OR lounge and come back and surgery is done. We still are controlling kind of every aspect and every maneuver of the robot. It's just it allows us to do things that we normally wouldn't be able to do with our hands. For instance, we can operate in very small spaces. We can do precise movements that just wouldn't be possible without a robotic interface. So it really allows us to be much more sophisticated in the type of operations we are doing. And it also allows us to work in really small areas. So traditionally, we do big, huge, open cuts to get into very small locations. Now we can do small cuts to get into those same locations just using a more sophisticated technology. What it means for patients is that they have very small incisions. The recovery usually is much more quick than traditional open surgery, allows them to get back to their regular activities, get discharged from the hospital sooner, and generally have better outcomes. What's unique about Kingston Health Sciences Center and this specific procedure is that we were able to combine two separate procedures into one procedure. We're very fortunate at Kingston Health Sciences Center that we have many excellent surgeons that like to work together. And what this means for patients is that we free up our schedules, we move things around, and try to free ourselves up to try to provide the best service we can for our patients. And in this particular case, myself and Dr. Bennett were able to clear our schedule and do two separate surgeries that usually require two separate hospital stays, two separate operations into one. And what was really unique about this is that most hospitals outside of Kingston do not have surgeons that are capable of doing both these types of surgeries robotically. They may have surgeons available to do one of the two procedures, but not both. And so we were able to combine our expertise and our availability and our collegiality to perform two surgeries on one day for one patient and allow them to kind of recover and get through this part of their care.
As Dr. Patel explained, the benefits include smaller incisions, quicker recovery, and fewer risks from repeat anesthesia. But this kind of innovation takes a whole team.
Robotic surgery includes the surgeon performing the surgery, the assistants assisting the surgeon to help them complete the procedure, as well as the nursing staff and anesthesia team. Many of our surgeons at Kingston Health Sciences Center have had training on robotic surgery during their residencies or fellowships. Some have acquired that skills through very dedicated pathways after they've already started their practice. And it tends to be very intensive because we want to ensure that we're offering this new technique safely and effectively for our patient group. With the surgeons, we work very closely with our nursing staff, and they require a huge amount of training to make sure they understand how the technology works. If there's troubleshooting that needs to be done, they're very capable of doing so. The robotic platform uses a lot of computer technology and requires a lot of advanced engineering, and it's a very complex piece of machinery. It almost always works flawlessly, but when it doesn't, we really need that extra training by the nursing staff and others on the ground to really resolve the issue as soon as we can. Because obviously, if something breaks down during a case, we want to make sure that we can get a patient safely through surgery. So it does require a lot of training to get it going. And then even once we start doing the cases, it still takes a bit of time for us to work out all the bugs and make sure we're doing things as efficiently as we can. For instance, in our group, we started by doing about one case per day, and took us a bit longer because we were careful and methodical, but now we're up to two and sometimes even three cases in a day just because of the efficiency and the experience that we've gained. So as I said, there's some training to begin with and then ongoing training and continuing education just to make sure that we continue to offer effective and efficient operations for our patients.
KHSC is hoping to expand by obtaining a second robotic platform, which would significantly increase capacity, with patients requiring liver, gallbladder, and pancreatic surgery being some of the first to benefit.
We have a lot of patients that would probably benefit from robotic surgery, and because of limited access, we haven't been able to implement as broadly as we would like. For instance, right now at Kingston Health Sciences Center, we do a large volume of urologic procedures, such as prostate and kidney surgeries, a lot of colorectal procedures, and gynecology procedures, as well as some lung procedures. What tends to be missing is the liver surgeries, upper gastrointestinal tract surgeries, and other abdominal surgeries that would benefit from robotic surgery, but we just don't have the access and couldn't get our surgeons trained in offering this type of procedure. So a second robotic platform really opens up that for us. It allows us to double our capacity. Already across the country, we're one of the highest performing surgery groups for robotic surgery. And this will really, I think, set us apart from our peers across the country.
Dr. Patel also spoke to what's next for Canada and KHSC in robotic surgery.
Well, I think across Canada and across specialties, there's been wide acknowledgement that robotic surgery really is the next phase of surgical innovation. Minimally invasive surgery through laparoscopic surgery was a huge revolution in how we offer surgical care. And that really came about in the 90s and 2000s. And in some ways, we in Canada, we've stalled a bit because we continue to offer laparoscopic surgery using technology that was developed 20 or 30 years ago. And we fell a bit behind some of our peers in the US, Europe, and other locations. What robotic surgery has largely been acknowledged to do is it allows for more complex and sophisticated and harder operations to be done minimally invasively. And it also allows surgeons that maybe couldn't have picked up the laparoscopic surgery skill set as easily to perform robotic surgery because it's an easier way to do surgery as a surgeon. And so that's in the next 5 to 10 years, really where we're going. It'd be very, I expect that in the next 5 to 10 years, very few surgeries will be completed laparoscopically and they'll be going more and more towards robotic surgery. And Kingston Health Sciences Center has played, I think, an influential part of how we've demonstrated the value of robotic surgery. For a lot of the colorectal procedures, it was perceived to be a very expensive way to do surgery with similar outcomes. And we've shown through our data that it's actually a very cost-effective way to offer an operation that allows patients to recover more quickly and thus save really the system a lot more money. So we've shown that it's actually very cost-effective and patients really benefit. We've also at Kingston Health Sciences Center trained fellows in robotic surgery. And the whole purpose of that is to disseminate how we do our surgery to other centers. We're also a host site for many observations for surgeons across the country that are interested in starting a robotic program and are seeking experience or information about how to do so. They tend to come to Kingston Health Sciences Center to see how we've rolled out a successful program. So although Kingston's a small city in the grand scheme of things, I think we've had a fairly influential role in rolling out robotic surgery across the country and really advocating for robotic surgery as a standard of care.
Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Friday, April 25th, it'll be cloudy but dry with a daytime high of 15 degrees, dropping down to 8 overnight with a 60% chance of precipitation. Saturday, April 26th, a little cooler, a little more rainy, high of 12 with a 40% chance of showers, dropping down to about 6 degrees overnight. Moving into Sunday, April 27th, we're going to have a beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 14 and it will be sunny. And then starting the next week, Monday, April 28th, it'll be 14 and cloudy. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The heavy load restrictions are in effect in Kingston until April 22nd. Until then, heavy trucks and loads are restricted on city roads where posted. These restrictions help reduce damage to roads in the spring. A complete list of roads with restrictions can be found on the Traffic Bylaw section of the City of Kingston website. Public Services and Procurement Canada wishes to advise the public that the LaSalle Causeway will be fully closed to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians on the following dates. Saturday, May 3rd from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., Saturday, May 17th from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Saturday, May 31st from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. During these periods, the removal of the modular bridge will begin at 6 a.m., with the marine channel expected to be open by 9 a.m. The marine channel will be closed at 5 p.m. to reinstall the bridge. The causeway is expected to reopen to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians by 8 p.m. Here are some road closures to be aware of. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Demare Street, Taylor Kidd to Wheat Hill is closed from April 22nd to May 2nd for servicing works. Russell Street, Patrick to Kent is closed April 23rd and 24th from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. for sanitary sewer line repairs. Victoria Street, Union Street to Johnson Street is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Here are some other relevant delays. Accommodation Road, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work around the newly installed culvert at the north end of Accommodation Road. Bayridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Gardner's Road at Centennial, and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving and signage to improve safety and efficiency, and to accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction for sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. This week, the Kingston Symphony Association is celebrating the successful completion of a new initiative in partnership with Concerts in Care Ontario. Concerts in Care Ontario is known for providing musical experiences to support the well-being of seniors across the province. Since its founding in 2011, the organization has presented over 2,500 concerts to more than 125,000 audience members in a wide variety of seniors' care settings. Throughout April, members of the symphony performed 8 chamber concerts in retirement and long-term care homes in Kingston and the surrounding region, designed to be accessible and enriching for seniors who may no longer be able to attend live performances. This initiative is part of the symphony's broader commitment to accessibility. In recent years, the organization has launched several inclusive programs, including relaxed performances and virtual concert options to reach a wider audience. Deborah Chandler, Executive Director of Concerts in Care Ontario, and Andrew Dicker, a musician with the Kingston Symphony, recently joined CFRC to reflect on the collaboration and its impact. How did this collaboration between Concerts in Care and the Symphony come together?
Concerts in Care has been looking to grow carefully and incrementally. We have a provincial mandate, and so far we're in Ottawa, Sudbury, Hamilton, the greater GTA. And before COVID, we were in Windsor and London, and that's a bit of a slow rebuild at this point. But we knew that Kingston was a wonderful place for musicians and for audiences. And we also explored a bit and found out that there's a number of long-term care and retirement and seniors programs in the area. And that's our whole mandate. And so originally, actually, the Kingston Musicians Association had gotten in touch with us and said, would you please come? And then the Kingston Symphony called us and said, we have some funding. Can you help us get into seniors' homes? So it just was such a great fit. And we do work with symphonies and whatever communities we're in. And the Kingston Symphony has been just a joy to work with. It's just been lots of fun to try and see how many places we can go in the short time we have. And we're splitting the costs so everybody wins.
Mm-hmm. And Andrew, I was wondering what your kind of thoughts were when you were originally approached to do these shows.
Well, it's really great because it's a really mutually beneficial thing for the members of the orchestra. It gives us an opportunity to perform in the community more, a little extra work. For members who come out of town, it's great for them because they can come in, do a little extra performing while they're here anyway. And it obviously from playing a couple concerts, it was the seniors seemed to really enjoy it. I did some violin duets with another violinist, a friend of mine, Curie, in the symphony, and I played a whole bunch of different selections. Some of them a little more traditional classical, and some of them a little weirder. And people seemed to enjoy it a lot. So it's seems to be working out really well for everyone.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we have so many performances in our community. We have the Grand, we have the Isbell, we have all these venues. I was wondering if you could just speak to the importance of bringing these concerts right to the seniors' homes.
Well, the difficulty for a lot of them is we have all these wonderful venues in town. I mean, anyone who's been to the Isabel knows it's a beautiful hall. But for a lot of these people, they just can't make it out there. Mobility issues, there's just a number of challenges. So if they can't get to us, we'll go to them. It just makes a lot of sense. A lot of the staff were also very happy to be able to watch the performance as well. And we're talking to us about how a lot of these people would have really enjoyed going to symphony concerts, but just can't make it out. And this is kind of the next best thing. And they seem to really enjoy it.
And I'd also add that music is just this wonderful, temporal, powerful thing. And that's why music itself is so popular in long-term care, especially, and in where all seniors are, because it reaches places that nothing else can. When language fails, music keeps going. And what these musicians do really is affect magic. They touch the hearts. You can be in a room full of retirement folk who have been subscribers to the symphony, and they're liable to critique you quite heavily if you're not doing what they think you should. But then you're also in long-term care where there may be catatonic people who haven't talked in months, but all of a sudden you see a little finger move, and all of a sudden somebody's clapping, or you see a toe or a little smile. And that is just why we do this.
What's the feedback been? What have you been hearing from residents and seeing and hearing from folks who work there?
Well, it's been a lot of fun. It's usually after the concert, we try to stay around for a little bit to talk to the residents. And I really enjoy when some of them come up to me and tell me how a piece of music reminded them of a memory from the past. I had a woman, one of the pieces that I played was a tango. She came up to me and told me about a time she'd been visiting, I don't remember which country in South America, and got to do some dances with tango dancers, and how it kind of brought her back to that. I really enjoy those kind of when it brings out a memory. That for me is really, I think, the most meaningful, because it means that music is connected with part of their life, part of their past, and brought them to that moment.
And that's what it's all about, is sparking those memories. And it helps recreate a sense of identity. And when the musicians go in, it connects them back to their community. They feel like they're still part of it. They still belong.
Once again, that was Deborah Chandler, Executive Director of Concerts and Care Ontario, and Andrew Dicker, a musician with the Kingston Symphony. Both organizations have expressed a strong interest in continuing their partnership, with hopes of bringing more live music to seniors' communities in the future. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go or hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.